Hi, this is Ebony, and before we jump into today's episode, I just want to give you an opportunity to sign up for my 5-day energy cleanse challenge, which begins on April 18th. That is tomorrow, and I'm super excited. We have some fabulous guests lined up that will be live streaming with me throughout the week, and I have some amazing challenges prepared and they are designed to disrupt your normal way of doing things so that you step into a new awareness. So visit zazzle.com and learn more info about the 5-day energy cleanse challenge and hopefully join the challenge. Now we're going to dive into my conversation with author Yoram Salomon.
And the bottom line is, that's not the case. Trust is relative. Trust is not absolute. It is not universal.
Hi, I'm Ebony, and I believe that stories change lives, and everyone has a story worth telling. Sometimes, unfortunately, we let our self-doubt get in the way of us writing our stories and sharing our stories. So that's why I created Motivation to Write as a source of motivation and inspiration to help writers like you and me share our stories with the world. So I talk to the experts ranging from entrepreneurs to marketers to authors to therapists to psychologists who share their knowledge and their advice to help writers like you and me step into our full potential.
Yoram Salomon is a professor, podcaster, and author of The Book of Trust and the book series, Can I Trust You? He's published 16 books and over 300 articles on trust, innovation culture, and entrepreneurship. He holds a PhD in organization management, an MBA, a law degree, and an engineering degree. I am here with Yoram Salomon, and I'm happy to have him because he is an expert on trust and the author of a book series called Can I Trust You? You actually have authored a lot of books, like 15, it looks like.
Actually, as of yesterday, 16.
Oh, congratulations. Okay, 16 books. Great. You have so much experience, and I'm just really excited to kind of get started here. But can you maybe give us a little background as to how did you step into this area of building trust? Where did that even start for you?
Well, if 30 years ago, I was working as an engineer, and if you would have told me that 30 years later, I would be talking about trust, I would think that you're crazy. But, you know, life has its own path, takes its own path. And my focus was on innovation. I was part of the group that ended up creating Wi-Fi and other technologies. I was on the early days before we even called it Wi-Fi. So innovation was my thing, and I was an innovator by myself. I helped other companies I worked for, companies I worked with, innovate things. And one thing that really annoyed me was that I noticed the difference in the level of creativity. I had my own startup companies. I sold a company. I bought a company. Then I worked in a very large company, technology company. And so when it was time for me to work on my PhD dissertation, my mentor, my committee chair, started, you know, I'm supposed to come up with a topic, and he started knocking all of my topics down because I was aiming pretty low. You know, I wanted to just get the dissertation done, be over with it, get my doctoral degree, and move on with my life. But he wanted me to come up with something that's going to be the way he phrased it, I want you to come up with a topic that will change your life and will change the lives of others, which is a pretty tall order. Yeah. And so I every topic I came up with, he shot it down, and then I was getting pretty annoyed. And at some point, he asked me a pivotal question. He asked me, Yoram, what pisses you off? And so I wanted to say, well, I'm trying to come up with a topic and you don't let me. But the words that came out of my mouth were, why are people so much more creative when they work in small startup companies than when they work in large mature companies? There was silence on the other side of the line. And then he said, I think we have a topic. So I spent the next 2 years doing that research. I researched, I used interviews. So I interviewed people from different companies, people in the US, Canada, China, Europe, Israel. Mm-hmm. And after 2 years, if I need to boil down everything that I found into two words, it will be innovation culture. It really comes down to culture. And what I found was, what is it about the culture that makes people more innovative or less innovative? Mm-hmm. That was the time when I actually launched what I call today my company, the Innovation Culture Institute. Mm-hmm. And starting to help companies, what I realized is that you can't start with generating ideas. You have to start with building the right culture for you to continue and generate ideas, because they can't just generate ideas when I'm in the room. They have to be able to do that by themselves, and you need to have the right culture. So one day, this was right when my seventh book, Culture Starts With You, Not Your Boss, that's the title of that book, book number seven, was with the editors. And I already have defined well what the components of an innovation culture are. I went to what was at the time a prospective client, and I sat with them and I started asking questions along the lines of a culture of innovation. And what I found was that they did not have a single component, positive component, that was required for a culture of innovation, but they had all the negative components that would prevent that culture from being built. And I was at that time, I was very curious to understand why. And so, you know, the more I dig deeper, why is that? And why is that? And why is that? What I find is that they lack trust. They don't trust management, doesn't trust employees. Employees don't trust management. Employees don't trust each other. Management doesn't trust each other. And I was fascinated. Mm-hmm. And so I started learning more about trust. The book came back from the editors, and I just wrote a 6-page epilogue chapter called Building Trust. So, you know, I know that you pay attention to grammar and English. And so if you read that book, I can almost guarantee that all of the typos and grammatical errors are in that 1 6-page chapter, because that never went through the editors. I added that after it came back from the editors. I published the book. That was the first time that I ever wrote about trust. And I started reading more and researching more. And I was fascinated. Trust, not only in the workplace, although that's mostly where I do my work, but also trust between people on a personal basis. Trust between a salesperson and a person that a customer. Trust between a government representative. I was actually elected to office. I served on the board of one of. You know, you're from Los Angeles. Los Angeles, I believe, has the largest school district. Mm-hmm. I served on the board of one of the top 100 school districts in the nation.
Wow.
And so the trust between a government representative and constituents and voters. Mm-hmm. And I started building a lot of content around trust. That was the time when I realized that, you know, starting with innovation is like starting to build a building from the second floor. You don't start with the second floor. The culture is on the first floor. You don't even start with that. You start with the foundation, and trust is the foundation for every relationship. And so at that time, I felt that I was kind of in a junction of, do I continue with innovation, which is what I've been doing for the last, I don't know, 30 years, or do I switch to trust, which is something that I've been researching only for the last 6-7 years? And I asked 20 of my closest friends and family members, what do you think I should do? Stick with innovation or turn to trust? And that 19 out of 20 said, stick with innovation. So I switched to trust.
That's okay. So explain the reasoning behind that. If most of them said innovation, but you switched to trust, what was the thinking behind that?
Robert Frost, The Road Less Taken.
Right?
It's not just that. It's one thing that I found, and that's true in life. You know, I have two daughters. One just finished college. Another one is in college. And what I found was that we pull people to our comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of pushing them away from theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Because to be successful, you can't operate in somebody else's comfort zone.
Right.
You need to actually move away from yours. You need to push the envelope. And what I realized is 19 out of 20 people really had my best interest in mind. They were trying to keep me safe. You know, go with this safe thing. You've been doing innovation for the last 30 years. Sorry, stay with that. And it's not that the 20th person didn't care about me. It's just that was the only person that said, move out of your comfort zone. And that's what I decided to do. That's what I've been doing for all of my life, getting away from pushing the envelope on my own comfort zone.
So that actually brings up an interesting topic, because that has to do with trust. In order to step out of your comfort zone, you have to have some level of trust with yourself to know that you're going to be okay, or that you have your own back. Did that come into play, or does that come into play for you whenever you are thinking of stepping into your comfort zone? How much do you trust yourself, and do you talk about that with people?
So there are two interesting, very interesting things, and they both are in the Book of Trust. By the way, I need to show you, since you're a teacher, you will appreciate books that have 550 pages. The Book of Trust, I just came out with the third edition, and that has 550 pages. But I also realized that, you know what, you would read a book with 550 pages. Many people would not. Right. And so what I decided was, since that book has a lot of the research, a lot of stories, but many people would just say, you know, just give me the what. Just give me the 8 laws of trust, the 6 components of trustworthiness, and 7-step process to form habits that will build trust. So that's the number 16. That's the one that just came out yesterday. I made the mini book of trust.
So
this one is like, you know, small form factor, 180 pages, easy to read, gives you everything. And
the snackable version.
You what?
It's like a snackable version, the snack, instead of the whole
meal. It's the one that you read in a few hours. You know, if the big book has about 160,000 words, this one has 40,000. So it's 25% off the main book. But you asked the question, and there are two things that come into play. One is, different people have different risk tolerance. Okay, some people have a higher risk tolerance, some people have a lower risk tolerance. And, you know, this is something that's unique about my perspective on trust and my whole trust habits model, where most people will tell you, here are the things that you must do or you must be to be trusted. And they look at it as very universal, very absolute. And I know it's easy to say, you know, there is a formula and this is it. And these are the 4 components or the 8 pillars or what have you. And you do them and you're going to be trusted. And the bottom line is, that's not the case. Trust is relative. Trust is not absolute. It is not universal. And I'll tell you one of the stories that I tell when I deliver my workshops. You know, you must have heard of the website called Rate My Professors, right?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah. So I never heard of that website. And one day my younger daughter was, signing up for classes in college. And I watched her. And she was doing it on a website called Rate My Professors. And I'm like, well, what is that? And she showed me, you know, I have to take this class, but there are several different professors. So I'm checking the professors. And I'm like, how do you know if they're good or bad? Well, previous students anonymously posted reviews. And I'm looking at the reviews and I'm thinking, man, this is brilliant. Mm-hmm. You know, but wait a minute. I'm a professor. Do I have a page on Rate My Professors? So she goes and she checks, and I do. I have a page, and there's like, at that time, there are like 15 reviews. And so I checked the reviews, and one of them gave me 5 out of 5, you know, Professor Salmon, he's awesome, he's this, is that. And, you know, great, something to put, you know, on your wall. But then I look at another one, and the other one gave me 1 out of 5. And you know the website, there is no 0. I mean, 1 is the lowest you get, and it says you're awful. It says that I'm condescending, I'm arrogant, and I use my own material instead of peer-reviewed journal articles and so on. It's like, you know, I teach entrepreneurship. It's really a very practical field. So, yeah, I do use my own material. But here was the funny part. I looked at, you know, it's anonymous. You don't know who the students are. But what you do know is what class they participated in and in what semester. And what I looked at, what I found was that these reviews were posted by students who sat at the same class in the same semester, in the same classroom. And I obviously was the same professor. How can two students look at you so differently? I mean, you probably see it in the classroom when two students would look, one student would just love you, think that you walk on water, you're the best teacher ever. And another student goes, yeah, I don't like this teacher. Trust works the same way. It is relative. And so, you know, risk taking is just one example. Some people are risk takers, some are not. I'm going to guess that you are a risk taker.
Yeah. Okay?
So imagine you're a risk taker and I'm not. I'm this risk averse person. My risk tolerance is very, very low, right? Mm-hmm. This is hypothetically, because in reality, I'm exactly the opposite. I'm like you. I'm a risk taker, which is obvious because when 19 out of 20 people say stick with innovation and I switch to trust, obviously I'm a risk taker. Well, here is something interesting that happens. First of all, which one of them is good? You know, being a risk taker or being risk averse? Well, the answer is neither or both. They're both good. There are things that are absolute or universal, like lying, like caring about me. You know, you shouldn't trust someone who doesn't care about you. You shouldn't trust someone who knowingly and intentionally is lying to you. That's universal. That's absolute. I get that. But there are other things like risk tolerance, like procrastination.
Yeah.
You know, it drives me crazy when I see my students submit their assignments. I give them 6 days to complete an assignment and they do that at the last hour. But you know something? It gives them opportunity to think about it more. It gives them opportunity to get other people's advice, to have new ideas and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's not bad. But two different types of people, a risk taker and a non-risk taker, a procrastinator and someone who likes to do everything the second they get the assignment, they tend to not trust each other. Mm. And so you asked about risk. So this is, you know, I'm a risk taker, but that means that there are a lot of people who are risk averse that don't trust me. I trust myself because I'm a risk taker, because I know that my risks are calculated. But there is another point. You asked about you trust yourself and what makes you trust yourself. First of all, the six components of trustworthiness, they apply to whether you trust other people, other companies, other things, yourself, and God. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that you have a limited amount of trust, which, by the way, is a function of all the risks that you're taking. If you're not taking risks, you don't need to trust anyone because you're not taking risks, right? So what do you need to trust? You need to trust people because you need to mitigate risk, right? So there is a limited amount of trust that you need in general based on the amount of risks that you're taking and your fear of that risk. Mm-hmm. But then comes the question of how do you balance that trust that you have between trusting yourself, trusting other people, trusting things, and even trusting God. And different people see that differently.
Right. Yoram, is there a hierarchy of trust? Like you mentioned, trusting people, trusting yourself, trusting God. Should you trust, like God, is it important that you trust your higher power first, like you have that trust intact, then trust yourself, and then trust other people? Is there like a trickle down effect? So for example, if I don't trust myself, how can I trust others? If I don't trust my higher power, how can I trust myself?
You know, and I'm glad you brought this up. I never thought about that. That's another area where I think that the way I look at trust is different than others. Because in most cases, this is what people tell you. You know, you got to start by trusting God or trusting the universe, however you want to call it. And then you must trust yourself. And then you must trust the people that are close to you and so on and so forth. I don't think that's the case. Hmm. I know people that don't trust themselves, but trust other people. You know, you mentioned I'm a pilot. Well, I fly small planes, right? I don't fly jets. Do you fly in jets? You do, right? You know, when you fly commercially, do you trust yourself more than you trust the pilot to land that plane? No. Right?
Okay. So, yeah.
And by the way, it brings another, I mentioned that I observed over the last 7 years, the 8 laws of trust, what I categorize as the 8 laws of trust. And one of them is that trust is contextual. You know, the question, do I trust myself more than others? My answer to that would be, in what? It depends. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, in flying an airplane, well, it depends on what airplane. In landing an F-18 on an aircraft carrier, it depends, right? So different people. So I don't think that you need to trust yourself so you can trust others. Mm-hmm. I think it's, first of all, it's contextual. Mm-hmm. That balance changes, but no, it's not. There is no hierarchy of trust, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
So, I guess we probably should have started off with the definition of trust. How do you define trust?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I went through the dictionary definitions and I went through all of the scholarly definitions of trust, and I came up with my own definition. And to me, trust is your willingness or the level of your willingness to give control over something that you have to another person, expecting them to maximize the potential negative consequences. Mm-hmm. So it's really about negative consequences. You know, if I'll give you an example. And by the way, this is my first law of trust. Trust is continuous. You know, we typically, the way we use the word trust is, I trust you, I don't trust you, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not binary. In a workshop, I ask people don't know me there, right? I mean, the person who hired me to do the workshop would know me. Maybe somebody else in the company knows me, but nobody else does. I mean, for them, that's the first time they see me. And I show up and I ask them, you know, I kind of am running out of gas. I need to stop at a gas station. How many of you are willing to lend me $20 so that I can fill gas? And I promise you, as soon as I get home, I'm going to write your name and address on an envelope. I'm going to put a $20 bill and I'm going to mail it back to you. How many of you are willing to lend me $20? Raise your hand. And so, you know, everybody pretty much raises their hand, and you know, I'm being realistic here. Half of them raise their hand because they were willing to give me $20. The other half, they raise their hands because they don't want the others to see that they were raising their hands. So $20, everybody raises their hands, because what's the maximum negative consequences? What's the worst thing that's going to happen? You're out $20. Right, okay, it's not the end of the world. For some people more, for some people less, but it's still $20. Then I ask about $100. You can imagine that about half the number of hands go down. Then I say $1,000. Maybe one or two, typically people who know me, which, by the way, brings the component of time, the amount of time you know someone. This is the part of where trust is dynamic. But then one time I was doing this workshop, I had about 500 people in the audience. It was funny because it was a state PTA conference. Mm. And so I spoke in a state PTA conference. And I asked, you know, $20, all the hands go up, $100, half or less, $1,000, one hand at the back. Like, okay, I have no idea who she is. $2,000, she raises her hand again. I'm like, man, I need to remember, at the end of this event, I need to go to her and take her name, telephone number, and email address, because if I ever need $2,000, that's what I call. So, you know, it's again, it's part of trust being relative, but it's continuous. It's not, I trust you, I don't trust you. And then the second part, the contextual part of it, is trust you with what?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we are starting our own businesses, or as writers, we're starting our own blogs or whatever we're doing, and we need to have our audiences trust, or at least we need to build an audience with trust. I mean, that's what the big components with building an audience, right, is that you have ethos that they can trust you. How do we do that?
I am so glad you asked that, because that's covered in the Book of Trust as well. Actually, I think that's even covered in the mini one. So trust, and this takes me into the six components of trustworthiness. What is it that makes me trust you? Okay. The six components, I broke them into three parts. You know, the funny part is, remember that six page that I wrote in Culture Starts With You, the first time I ever wrote about trust? Those were the same six components that I identified back then. Still, I changed the names on one of them, but still the same six components. So I break them into two parts: who you are and what you do. Who you are is made of three parts: your competence, personality compatibility with me, the person who thinks about trusting you, and the symmetry of our relationship. Symmetry, fairness is part of it. So I'll just tell you what the other three is, and then I'll answer your question based on those six. The other three are what you do. So the who you are is what I can find about you without even interacting with you for the first time. The what you do, that's happening with every interaction. Your blog, your book, there are one-way interactions, but they are still interactions. And they are made of the positivity, time, and intimacy. And I'll touch on those. So let me start with the who you are, okay? Competence. You want your audience to trust you. Well, part of them trusting you is your competence. How can you convey your competence through your writing, through your blog, through your podcast, through your video cast? How can you convey competence? Well, when you show that you've been doing that for a while, when you're doing it well, when you are confident. You know, I don't know if you remember, do you remember the movie Zero Dark Thirty?
I definitely have heard of it. I don't know if I've ever seen it.
It was about the raid, the Navy SEAL Team 6, their raid to get Osama bin Laden.
There's
a part in the movie where Jessica Chastain plays the CIA agent Maya.
I have seen this movie. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So there is a part there where she's there with the Navy SEAL team members. And one of the Navy SEAL team members talks to the other one and he says, you know, do you really believe her? He talks about Maya, the CIA agent. Do you really believe her? Osama bin Laden? We're going after Osama bin Laden. Do you believe her that he's there? He said, yeah. And the first one goes, what convinced you? What convinced you? And he turns to her and he says, her confidence. And so confidence, the confidence that you project, you know, like I look at you right now, Ebony, and you project confidence. And that makes people trust you. That's part of this whole competence component.
Right.
Okay, that's one. The second one is personality compatibility. You remember my two students. One of them thought I walk on water, 5 out of 5. The other one thought I was 1 out of 5, right? And it's not that I was bad or good, but there are things there that just, you know, worked really well with one student and not with the other. Will all of your readers trust you? No.
Right.
You know, I like reading fiction too. And so before you read a book, you want to read reviews, right? And so I look at the reviews. Reviews are pretty high, but I typically tell me you don't do the same thing. You look at the bad reviews first, right? You look at the one-star reviews first. By the way, that goes into the positivity part, because research showed that bad is much, much stronger than good. So people would have a much stronger, call it allergic reaction to the bad things that you do than a positive reaction to the good things that you do. But so positive, so I'm sorry.
No.
Personality compatibility is going to play a role. And you will see that some people, you know, not everybody is going to like your podcast. Right. Not everybody is going to like what you write. There are going to be people who are very, very critical. And I know I have my own podcast. Actually, a first episode of the fourth season just came out yesterday. Today, I'm going to be recording a few other episodes for the podcast. Not everybody's going to like it. And that is okay. You always need to focus on those that you really talk to. Symmetry is a little tricky in one-way communication because one-way communication, by definition, is not very symmetrical. But, you know, when we start talking about having the same vision, the same mission, the same values, people start thinking that we're on the same side as they are, and they tend to read our content, trust our content more. Then come the three components of what you do. The first one is positivity. I already mentioned that. I have two subcomponents for that. One is the level of BS. You know, how much BS do you bring? And do you really think that people don't see through the veil of BS and they go, well, what he wrote here, that's total BS. And, you know, I know it, he knows it. And so they treat it as such. The second part is, you know, a nice word for it would be individualism. A more accurate is going to be the world revolves around me. There was a study done, I think it was in 2015, that looked at the World Values Survey database. And what they found was that we are today 12% more self-centered in our values and our practices than we were 51 years ago. Well, you might say, okay, 12%, it's not that big a deal. It's 69% in English-speaking countries. 69%.
Oh, wow.
We are 69% more self-centered today than we used to be 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? If your writing is all about me, 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 do you get people to trust you, that you care about them? The last two components, one of them is time and the other one is intimacy. Time is how much time do I spend with you? How often do I do that? So let's talk about a blog. Do you release your blog every week? Does your blog only have one paragraph every blog post? Or does it have 500 to 800 words, which is kind of the ideal size for a blog post? Can't even say the words anymore. So if you do it once a week, and I was very committed, it was really hard for me. Last Sunday, not yesterday, the Sunday before last was the only day since I started my podcast where I did not release an episode. And the reason was it was right after Christmas, right before New Year's, and I figured it's just going to be a waste of time and people are going to miss an episode. Mm-hmm. So at the last minute, I moved the episode, the first episode of the fourth season, to yesterday so that people would see it. But other than that, I'm committed. You know, you can count on the fact that predictability, by the way, plays a big part of it. You know that every Sunday at 12 noon, there is a new podcast episode from me on The Trust Show. So if it's just one paragraph, I'm not building a lot of trust. If it's longer, I'm building more. Again, to a point, you can write too much and they're still not going to read it. And the last part is intimacy. There is intimacy through words. I don't know if you ever read, actually, he was a professor at UCLA, Albert Mehrabian. He wrote a book in 1971 called Silent Messages. And he was the one who created, you probably remember the 7-38-55 rule, right? 7% words, 38% tone of voice, 55% body language.
Yes.
One of the most misquoted rules ever. Because he was talking about liking and he was talking about feeling. And people quote this as, we communicate 7% through words, 38% through tone of voice, and 55% through body language. That's not the case. He was talking about feeling and liking. I read, this is a 1971 book, and I read his research, original research that he did in 68 and 69. And to be honest, I don't know that I would draw these numbers from that research. I would dig deeper. But let's just agree on one thing. You know, I can do this exercise with you, and you probably have done that with your students, so you already know. I tell people in my workshops, hold one finger up. Hold one finger up. Touch your forehead. Touch your nose. Touch your chin. What did I say? I said chin. That's not a chin. That's a cheek.
Oh, my God.
You know why? Because you looked at my body language more than you listened to the words.
Right.
And so that's what we do. So let's just agree that we listen to the that we listen to the tone and we look through body language. Wow. This is why, if you remember, right before you started recording, I asked you if you're actually posting the video as well. Yeah. Because you will build more trust when people can hear you than if they can read you. Mm-hmm. And you will build even more trust when people can see you and hear you and not just read your words. And the most important part here, which, you know, from the whole Albert Mehrabian book, the one paragraph that I take from the introduction to his book that I think is the best is where he said that when your words and nonverbal communications are inconsistent, people distrust you.
Right.
So you want to build trust as an author. Write consistently, write frequently, keep in touch with your audience, let them hear your voice, have a podcast as well, let them see your face, have videos as well.
Okay. So I think you answered one of the questions I was writing when you started to talk about building trust and how much, my question was, how much does trust have to do with being liked? So they are very much intertwined. I mean, in order for people to trust you, there is an element of they have to like you.
You know, I wouldn't put this at 100% correlation. Are there people that you like that you don't trust? Yes, but this is because we're going back to trust is contextual.
Yeah.
So there are people that I like, and I trust them in certain things, but not in other things. So you know what, Ebony, I like you, but I'm sorry, I don't trust you enough to fly an airplane that I'm sitting in the back of.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Doesn't mean that I don't like you.
Right.
And there are people that I trust. You know, many years ago, I went through surgery. That surgeon, he was obnoxious. I mean, he would never be a friend of mine. I don't like him. I still don't like him. You know, this is what, 25 years later, I still don't like him, but I trusted him with what he did.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that goes back into trust is contextual, the second law of trust.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's really, that's a big one, that trust is contextual.
Yeah.
Because you might, for example, the person that you like them because they're funny or, you know, they have a great personality, but you wouldn't necessarily trust them to manage your money. I think that there is an element of trust in that you trust them to make you feel good when you're feeling down, right? If they're funny and likable, but you're not necessarily going to trust them to manage your finances.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, if you're the blogger or the podcaster, and let's say something happens and you haven't posted for a while, like a month or whatever, and you start to lose your audience's trust because they're like, well, where is she or where is he, blah, blah, blah. Is there, and you've lost them as an audience, some of them maybe have just completely tuned out. Is there a way you can regain trust if you've lost it?
Hey, those are great questions. So first of all, this comes back to you never get a second chance to make a first impression. You know, I tried to find out who was the original source of this quote, and there are so many people listed, so I don't think we'll ever find out who said it first. But you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. This is important, not only in a matter of seconds. You know, Ebony, you and I just met for the first time today for this podcast, right? The first few seconds you made an impression on me, I made an impression on you. It's going to be harder or less impact the next 8 seconds, the next 15 minutes, the next hour, the next day, the next year is harder. So that's something to keep in mind, that you're building this rapport with your audience. You didn't lose your audience. If you didn't write for, 3 weeks, you didn't lose your entire audience, not completely. If you've been writing for a year and you missed 3 weeks, you didn't lose them. But having said that, remember that I said that bad is much stronger than good. Mm-hmm. By the way, there are two Israelis, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Amos Tversky have passed, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2002 for a theory they developed in 1979 called the prospect theory. And in that theory, they talked about investments and how we look at risk versus how we look at reward and benefits. And we are a lot more driven by negative things than by positive things. There is something called the Losada ratio by Barbara Fredrickson, I can't remember his first name, but his last name is Losada, and that's called the critical positivity ratio of 2.90313. I'm sorry. If you Googled the number 2.9013, you're going to find something that's called the critical positivity ratio, which they claim is the ratio between how we respond to bad versus good. So 3 times stronger than good. I don't know if the number is 3 times or not, but where is that in the context of your question? When you stopped recording, you stopped posting, you did something, let's call it something bad, okay, as opposed to post one more episode. When you missed one episode, let's say that it's 3 times worse than having one positive episode, posting one episode. So theoretically, you need to post 3 more episodes to compensate for that one missed episode. But if you lost 4 episodes, you may have to post 12 new episodes before people who stopped trusting you go, okay, she's back. So, we're going to let this one go. So there are 2 things that I want you to keep in mind. One of them is that you don't lose trust as quickly the longer time passes. Even when someone betrays you, think about all those people who just live with someone who abuses them. Mm-hmm. Why don't you leave? Well, because we had a very long, very positive relationship. And these are just those little things, right, that are happening now. So people are not willing to completely lose trust and say, okay, I'm done. One strike and you're out. This is why we have 3 strikes and you're out, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you don't do that. But a strike is much stronger than a hit. So if you strike out, you just know that it's going to take a harder work to gain that trust back. And frankly, is there a way where you don't lose them, where you don't stop posting, or at least before it happens, or even while it happens, you explain it? I only missed 1 episode. I actually delayed 1 episode, the first episode of the 4th season. And what I did was I re-recorded the ending of the last episode of the 3rd season and added that statement saying, I'm going to skip 1 week and because I know that it's Christmas, that this is going to be the day after Christmas and then we're going to have New Year's. I know you have other things on your mind. I don't want you to miss an episode because it's on a Sunday that you don't have time to listen to it. So I am delaying that 1 episode. Mm-hmm. So if you see that this is coming, or even if you don't know that this is coming and all of a sudden, surprise, I can't record, I can't write this week, just write something, even if you write a paragraph and you say, something is going on this week. By the way, that's part of personality compatibility, your mm-hmm. transparency, saying mm-hmm. this is happening to me this week. Or this month, I'm undergoing something. Unfortunately, these days I'm hit with COVID. I don't think that I can write this week. So stick with me. You're going to get another episode in 2 weeks. So much better than just disappearing without explanation, because that goes back into, well, now I distrust you, not just because you stopped writing, but also because you completely disappeared. without a clue, without letting me know, which I have to wonder, do you care about me as your reader?
You know, we are running out of time, but when you were talking about like rebuilding trust, and then you mentioned how we can be living with someone who is totally abusive and we still continue to trust this person. Do we trust too easily sometimes? I mean, we talk about building trust with people, but when we're the people that are being persuaded to trust.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you asked it this way. I would say that we are too hard before we trust rather than too easy. One of the habits that I promote is start with trust, because trust is reciprocal. Okay. And I'm not talking about I trust you, you trust me. Here is another story that I use in my workshops. Maya, my older daughter, she was about a year old. And, you know, when you're a year old, this is when you just about lift yourself from crawling to standing. Mm-hmm. And so she looks around, she goes, oh, I can stand. So what's the next thing she's going to try? Well, I'm going to try walking.
Yeah.
And she starts walking and she's like, oh, I can walk. And after she realized she can walk, the next thing she's going to try is she's going to
run.
Run, exactly. She's going to try and run. And the first time she's going to run, what do you think is going to happen? She's going to fall. Yeah. And the first thing she's going to do is she's going to
cry.
No, she's not.
Oh, going to get up.
No, she's not. The first thing she's going to do, Ebony,
look at you.
She's going to turn around and look at me.
Yeah. Okay.
She's going to look for a clue. Yeah. If I'm going to go, she's going to start crying because obviously something terrible had happened. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to go, get up, keep going, she's going to get up and keep going. And apparently nothing terrible had happened. Trust works that same way as well. Hmm. If I trust you and I show you that I trust you, you will behave in a trustworthy way, because otherwise you have cognitive dissonance. Your brain goes, well, they trust me, but I'm not to be trusted. And then this, you know, my mind is blowing. So when you trust somebody and you show them that you trust them, they will behave in a more trustworthy way than they were before. And so I don't know that we trust too easy. I think that we trust too hard. And I think that we need to take a leap of faith a little and say, you know what, based on my assessment of you right now, I think that I can trust you at a 54% level. Remember, trust is continuous. It's not zero or one. 54% trust level. I'm going to trust you with 58%. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a little more. Mm-hmm. And that would increase your trustworthiness. So I don't think that we trust too easy, but I do want to bring in the eighth law of trust. And the eighth law of trust is that the trust I have in you is the product of my trustability, my willingness to trust other people, and your trustworthiness. And there's almost nothing you can do about the former and everything you can do about the latter. This is why, you know, in my workshops, I typically break them into three parts. The first part, this is what I want you to get. I want you to get that the foundation for everything is trust, but the building block of trust is your trustworthiness. It's not, oh, what can you do to me for me today so that I will trust you? No, it's what can I do today so you'll trust, so that you'll trust me. Ask not what others can do to earn your trust. Ask what you can do to earn their trust. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is rip on JFK's inaugural address in 1961. But those relationships, it's not that abusive relationships, it's not that we trust too easy. It's that we've been in that relationship for so long that we don't accept that it changed. I would, you know, we're going to be pressed to find an abusive relationship that started abusive.
Right.
I mean, when you meet someone, you trust them zero. And they start with abuse, bam, I'm out of here. That's it, right? It's not that. It's not then. It's not there. It's when the relationship starts well. It starts with respect. It starts with love. It starts with a lot of things that build trust. And all of a sudden, abuse comes in, and we're not willing to say, well, we're going to zero. This is it. I'm out of here. That's what happens. By the way, one of the people that I interviewed for the Book of Trust is one of Israel's leading divorce attorneys. And she told me a lot of stories about trust and about abusive relationships and how they reach the end.
Wow, that sounds like another episode. We can talk all, another conversation. This has been wonderful. Yoram, I'm so happy that you shared your expertise and wisdom and knowledge about trust with us, because I think that you brought up a lot of points that we simply don't think about. Like, for example, when you first talked about innovation culture and that there needs to be a level of trust in order to kind of aid the innovation and creativity. I never even really thought about that in that context. It is super important that you have trust amongst your colleagues or people that you're working with to kind of cultivate the creative energy.
By the way, if I can just, I'll be very brief.
Yeah.
The reason is because we need, and this is one of the components of a culture of innovation, the ability to hold a constructive disagreement. And, you know, unfortunately, in America today, we are losing that ability to hold a constructive disagreement, which means I'm willing to be completely vulnerable with you. And hopefully you saw in the last almost hour that I was completely vulnerable with you. Mm-hmm. I was willing to give feedback and I was receptive to feedback. And the thing is, your vulnerability goes to zero the first time you don't trust me. So if you don't trust me, you're not going to be willing to ask stupid questions and suggest stupid ideas. Mm-hmm. You know how many great things ever happened because somebody asked a stupid question?
Right.
This would never have happened if they did not trust the others to not make fun of them into their faces or behind their backs. So this is why trust is so important for creativity and productivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that definitely plays into the classroom. If you can cultivate an environment where people are not scared to ask stupid questions and you make it clear that it's not cool to make fun of someone's comment or to, you know, call someone's opinion stupid, you know, it does really, it raises obviously the trust in the classroom. And then you start getting all these really great ideas from kids that aren't scared to share them.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay. So tell us where we can find you.
Well, you can find me in two places, yoramsolomon.com, yoramsolomon.com, or easier to spell, trusthabits.com. Both are the same website, trusthabits.com. Obviously, you can listen to the Trust Show podcast starting this year. It's also a video cast, so you'll see that on YouTube as well.
And I'm going to give you this opportunity, if you have any last words of encouragement for people who are maybe just starting off with their business or with their blog, which is kind of like a business, and they're trying to build trust with clients or with an audience, and they're feeling like they're not really, they don't know what they're doing. How can they?
I think the statement that, sorry, that I like to use the most is that I like to close with is really on the importance. The answer to this question will have the biggest impact on your professional and personal success or failure. Can I trust you? I can't boil it all into one paragraph, the 8 laws of trust, the 6 components of trustworthiness, the 7-step process to form habits that will make you trustworthy. It's all in the Book of Trust and my podcast and everywhere else. It's just that the importance, nothing is more important than the answer to that question. Can I trust you?
Okay. Thank you so much. I'm going to stop recording. I'm just going to chat for a moment with you. That was a very enlightening conversation with Yoram about trust. There were a few things I had never really thought of. I think the biggest takeaway for me is that trust is contextual, that you may trust one person with one thing and not the other thing. or with several things, but not this one thing, or with this one thing, but not several things. It just really depends. And the idea that we don't trust too easily, we're actually very difficult when it comes to trusting in the beginning of relationships. So I hope that if you are interested in this idea of trust, which, I mean, that's a part of our everyday lives, then that you check out Yoram's website and, of course, his books and his podcast and all that he has to offer, because it really does change your perspective on how you communicate with your audience and with your clients and with your family and friends when you have a deeper understanding of how trust works. So please visit his website. In the meantime, also visit zazil.com and sign up for my newsletter. And you can follow me on social media. I'm on Facebook at Motivation to Write and at Motivation to Heal. I'm on Instagram at Motivation to Write, and I'm on Twitter at Ebony Haywood. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I will see you next time when I talk to another fabulous guest. Okay, bye-bye.